Do you know someone who's a Philistine? A boorish, brutish barbarian? Someone who's uncultured, uncivilized, uncouth, and uncultivated? A lowbrow, loutish, primitive clod? If so, write his name down in your vocabulary notebook next to Philistine. And don't bother inviting him to join your book club or on your next outing to the opera. You'll be wasting your time. Okay, we're returning from the hinterlands of the unsophisticated, barbaric Philistines back to the more civilized, scholarly world of ivy-covered walls, academia, and knowledge. Specifically, we're going to finish our lecture by tackling three related words that are sometimes confused. Erudite, esoteric, and recondite. Let's start with erudite. Erudite is an adjective that means learned or scholarly, characterized by deep and extensive knowledge. It's usually a good thing to be, unless you're a Philistine, of course. You can describe particularly knowledgeable people, like a professor, as erudite, and very scholarly books, articles, and conversations as erudite. For me, erudite immediately brings to mind my dissertation advisor at the University of Virginia. She seemed to know everything about literacy, and seemed to have read everything about literacy. She was my academic rock star. I know, that's pretty nerdy. Now, I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, but I remember one time I thought I had unearthed an obscure article that she hadn't read. I was really looking forward to showing off my erudition at our next seminar. Or so I thought. I know, pride goeth before a fall. So, when I brought up this article in our next class, my advisor said something like this. You're right, Kevin. That's a significant and still timely study that deserves to be better known. There's a few more by that same research group we should all look at. Let's add those to the class readings for next week. Well, as you can imagine, I got some pretty baleful stares from my classmates. From that class on, I tried to keep my aspirations toward erudition in check. Synonyms for erudite include lettered, brainy, scholarly, and learned. Now, erudite comes from the Latin verb erudio, to educate, teach, and instruct. This Latin word, in turn, is derived from the Latin prefix ex and the Latin adjective rudis. Ex means out of, and rudis means unpolished, rough, and unlearned. We get the word rude from it. So, if you are erudite, you are literally brought out of a rough, raw, unlearned state. You're polished through education. That's a nice visual. So in your vocabulary notebook, highlight the E in erudite and note that this is a variant spelling of the prefix EX, meaning out of. And highlight the R-U-D-I and connect it to rude, rough, unlearned. Remember, an erudite person has come out of the rough. And most importantly, think of the most wicked smart person that you know, someone who's incredibly learned and scholarly. Make a personal connection and write down their name next to erudite. And please don't try and show off by showing them some obscure article. They've probably already read it. So, erudite means scholarly. But have you ever read something that was too scholarly for you? So deep and profound, it was incredibly difficult to understand? Something that was so hard to fathom, it gave you a headache, made your teeth hurt, and forced you to sigh in despair and throw your highlighter across the library? Maybe it was a physics textbook, an article for your advanced philosophy class, or a term paper written by your incredibly erudite roommate. Whichever it was recondite, our next target word. Recondite is an adjective meaning difficult to understand. If something is way beyond the capacity of the average Joe to comprehend, it's recondite. Let's put recondite in context. Although the recondite economic paper contained some important findings, it didn't make an impact because very few could understand it. Now, recondite's a pretty fancy scholarly word to describe something that's just plain difficult to understand. If you want a sophisticated synonym for recondite to use with your hoity-toity friends that will make you appear erudite, you can also use the word abstruse, However, if you're just hanging around your buddies drinking a few cold ones, and you want to comment on something you recently read that was difficult to understand, but think recondite and abstruse will get you laughed out of the room, you could just use the word deep or say, dude, that was heavy. Okay, we're moving from erudite, meaning learned, and from recondite, meaning difficult to understand, to our final target word dealing with teaching and learning, a very mysterious word. Now, as I've mentioned before in this course, I am not a handy guy. When I was first married, my father-in-law, who had grown up on a farm in South Dakota and was driving a tractor at the age of 11, gave me a few tools to add to my toolbox. But I was too ashamed to tell him that at the time that I didn't have a toolbox. However, I did have a tool bag, a gift bag my wife had given me as a joke to keep the few tools that I did have, a hammer, a wrench, and a few screwdrivers. I know, pitiful. I always wondered about folks who were handy. How did they learn to unclog a drain, change the oil in their cars, and put in a new toilet? Where did they acquire this secret knowledge? When I became a dad, would I be whisked away in the middle of the night, initiated into the secret inner circle of the handy and the skilled, shown the secret handshakes, and given a book that would show me how to fix anything? Well, it never happened. To this day, this type of handyman knowledge still remains esoteric to me, our final target word. Esoteric is an adjective meaning understood by only a select group. Esoteric describes secret or specialized knowledge that might seem mysterious because it's known only to an enlightened inner circle. For example, the intricacies of a software program might seem esoteric to everyone but the programmers. So let's put esoteric in context. That exclusive group of professors loves to cite esoteric articles that only they understand. Arcane is a synonym for esoteric. So remember, esoteric and recondite can both describe knowledge that is beyond the power of the average Joe to understand. However, use recondite to stress that it's the profundity of the ideas and the remoteness of the subject to normal interests that makes it difficult to comprehend. But use esoteric to stress that the knowledge is secret, guarded, or known by a select group of initiates or students. With all this talk of secret and specialized knowledge, let's briefly discuss the Greek root meaning know, usually spelled G-N or G-N-O. Now, this is a powerful root you'll see in derived words like cognition, the act or process of knowing, which will be our key word for this root. Now, when you recognize someone, you literally know them again. Other derived words that include this G-N root include incognito and cognizant. Now, you may have encountered the related word gnosis, which is secret knowledge of spiritual mysteries, and Gnosticism, a religious movement in the 2nd century CE. Gnosticism claimed that salvation came from acquiring secret, esoteric knowledge. Other derived words include agnostic, diagnosis, ignorant, and prognosis and prognosticate, both sharing the core meaning of knowing something before. Okay, today we've learned the following target words: induction, deduction, exegesis, perspicacious, didactic, philistine, erudite, recondite, and esoteric. And with all this talk about thinking, teaching, and learning, I'm sure that you're ready for a study break. In the meantime, be on the lookout for an opportunity to use one of today's target words if you get into a conversation about teachers or education. See you next time.
Lecture 19, Words for the Diligent and the Lazy.
We've all heard the aphorism that there's no substitute for hard work. But if you've ever worked with any group, you know that not everyone's a hard worker. Now, some folks really are diligent and dogged, persistently plugging away. These busy beavers won't give up until the job's done. Others are highly skilled, competent, and technically adroit. These crackerjacks and polished professionals have the know-how and the expertise to do the job and do it well. Others are cheerful and optimistic, almost bullish, beaming, and buoyant. They give us that shot of energy that we need when we're flagging. And like it or not, there's always a few who are just downright lazy, idle, sluggish, apathetic, and slothful. You've got to watch these laggards, slackers, loafers, clock watchers, and do-nothings like a hawk. These layabouts follow the advice of Paul Terry, the noted American cartoonist and film producer, when he said, "When I feel like exercising, I just lie down until the feeling goes away." So today, we'll be exploring different words that describe different types of working and doing. So before we start, I'd like you to take a 2-question quiz. Don't worry, you won't be graded. You'll find out the answers to this quiz during the lecture. Okay, number 1, true or false? You would not want to hire a sedulous worker because they're always late, lazy, and lethargic. Question 2, what's the difference between these 3 commonly confused words, torpid, turgid, and turbid? For our first target word, I'd like to share a story from my own childhood. Now, as I mentioned before, I grew up an Army brat. My dad was a U.S. infantry officer who served in the Special Forces, more popularly known as the Green Berets. Now, as you might imagine from this, my dad was a pretty gung-ho person and constantly stressed the importance of hard work, stick-to-itiveness, and a never-say-die attitude. And he tried to transfer this gung-ho-ness and work ethic to my sister, my 2 brothers, and me. Now, as fairly young children, and this is the truth, we would actually have PT, military parlance for physical training, many mornings starting at 0:30. Then my dad had erected a pull-up bar in our backyard, and alongside him, as the sun rose, we'd do pull-ups, push-ups, sit-ups, and some mornings go for a run. We must have posed quite a sight on those early morning runs around our neighborhood. My dad had actually bought us matching jogging gear with our names scripted on the chest. We'd run behind him in uniform and close formation, with my dad calling out the military cadence in his gruff manner, and us responding in our high-pitched preteen voices. "I don't know, but I've been told. I don't know, but I've been told. We're gonna jump from a big iron bird. We're gonna jump from a big iron bird. Stand up, hook up, shuffle to the door." You get the picture. If we ever started flagging during any of these exercises, my dad had some pretty unique motivational ploys. But our all-time favorite was what we called the Cold War Motivator. Now remember, this was the early 1980s at the height of the Cold War. And if I was on my 22nd push-up and was struggling to get the last 3 pumped out, my dad would try to light a fire under me by saying, "Kevin, there's another 10-year-old boy in Russia right now doing his 22nd push-up, and he's thinking about quitting. Are you going to let him beat you? Are you, son?" So as a kid, I always wanted to meet my Russian counterpart and share my stories to see if his dad was as gung-ho, as persistent, and as doggedly determined and as crazy as mine. My dad perfectly exemplifies our first target word, sedulous. Sedulous is an adjective meaning diligent in application or in the pursuit of something, persevering, constant in effort. Sedulous can describe both people and their work. Let's put sedulous in context. The sedulous workmanship of the master carpenter was evident in the perfection of every single detail of the stunning table, from the exquisitely turned legs to the tongue and groove joints, which fit together like a glove. Now, synonyms for sedulous include diligent, assiduous, persistent, tenacious, and pertinacious. Oh, we have a usage alert. A quick usage note about those last 2 synonyms. Pertinacious is related to the word tenacious, but they are not exact synonyms. As observed by Rod L. Evans in his excellent resource, The Artful Nuance, tenacious has a more positive connotation, suggesting a determined course of action, holding fast, either literally or figuratively, despite all opposing forces. As in the following sentence, the cancer survivor's tenacious spirit, overcoming years of setbacks, chemotherapy, and radiation, inspired others. Pertinacious, while also sharing this basic meaning of holding resolutely to a course of action, purpose, or opinion, carries the additional negative connotation of being so tenacious as to become annoyingly stubborn, obstinate, and objectionably persistent. You know these pertinacious types. They keep at it and at it and at it until they've annoyed the heck out of everyone. The pertinacious questioning of the high-strung, hyper-student annoyed his professor and the rest of his classmates so much, the professor put an end to open discussion in class. So, to remember our initial target word, sedulous, think of the hardest-working person that you know. Maybe it's a friend, a colleague, or a relative. Visualize this sedulous person and write their name and an example of their hard work in your vocabulary notebook next to your entry for sedulous. And most important, always try and hire or work alongside a sedulous person. Sedulous individuals never drop the ball or let you down. They'll make you look good. Okay, we're moving on from sedulous workers who are indefatigable and dogged in their unwavering and unflagging pursuit of a goal to another positive type of work, skilled and proficient work. Our next target word is facile. Facile is an adjective that can mean done or achieved with little effort or difficulty. Easy. Performed with effortless ease and fluency. You can use facile to describe work, actions, speech, and movements. Let's put facile in context. The mathematician's facile mind enabled her to find the solution before others had even figured out how to approach the problem. Or, the professor's facile wit kept his students on their toes and engaged the entire class. Now, whenever I think of facile, I think of my wife's beloved Uncle Jim. Uncle Jim was one of those amazing people who seems to be able to fix everything with great skill and ease. It doesn't look like they ever break a sweat. It seemed that there was no problem involving machinery or mechanics that Uncle Jim's facile mind couldn't solve. For example, one time, Uncle Jim was driving his Chevrolet Corvair when it broke down in the middle of nowhere. When he looked under the hood, he found that there was a hole in the gas line. On the side of the road, with no one around, Uncle Jim looked around, his facile mind quickly finding a solution. He saw a bunch of cattails growing by the side of the road in a marshy section of land. Realizing that they were hollow in the center, he took one, cut it to size with his pocket knife that he always carried with him, and slipped it over the gas line. This jerry-rigged system did the trick until he reached the next town. Another time, Uncle Jim used his own necktie to temporarily fix a broken belt in the engine. If those aren't examples of a facile mind at work, I don't know what are. Now, can you find a root in the word facile that we've already explored in a previous lecture? A root that means make or do? If you said F-A-C, you're right. So to remember facile, highlight the Latin root F-A-C in your vocabulary notebook. F-A-C means make or do. And if you're facile at something, you can do it easily and effortlessly. And remember factory, our key word for FAC? People in a factory make or do things. It's a busy place. Other derived words we've explored in previous lectures include factitious, malefactor, someone who does evil, and factotum, someone who does everything, a jack of all trades. Now, let's dig even deeper into this powerful root. FAC is also commonly spelled in three other ways. F-E-C, in words like effective, F-I-C, in words like artificial, made by humans, not natural, and F-Y, a verb-forming suffix of this root meaning to make into. We see this F-Y suffix at the end of words like sanctify, to make sacred or holy, magnify, to make bigger, dulcify, to make sweeter, and one that I love and don't think we use enough, stupefy, to stun, literally to make into a stupor. So, next to facile in your vocabulary notebook, write that the FAC root means make or do. And note that our keyword for this root is factory, a busy place in which people make or do a lot. Note the new morphological information that we learned here, that you'll also see this FAC root commonly spelled F-E-C, F-I-C, or F-Y at the ends of words. And when you see any of these letters in a word, there's a good chance it may have something to do with making or doing. A great hook to remember a word's meaning. Now here are two other words closely related to our target word facile, facility and facilitate. So next to facile, write the words facility and facilitate. If you have the facility for a task or job, you have the aptitude or skill. You can do it easily and effortlessly. Or if you facilitate something, you make doing it easier. So connect these related words. A facile person has the facility to facilitate work. Synonyms and related words for facile include skilled, adroit, adept, dexterous, and proficient. All right, we have a usage alert. Facile has another definition that you may encounter. Our first definition, done with ease and effortlessly, is a positive connotation. But if you do something with too much ease, you may do it in a superficial, nonchalant, careless way. So this is the second negative connotation of facile, done with too much ease, showing little care, little attention to detail. It may seem kind of surprising that a word can have both a positive and a negative connotation, depending on how it's used. But that's the case with facile, which in a negative sense can actually mean shallow, simplistic, not deep. As in the sentence, his facile answers on the essay exam earned him a D on the test. So be on the lookout for both meanings for facile. Remember, words live in context. That's why context matters. Okay, let's move on from our sedulous and hardworking workers and from our facile and skilled workers to a third type of worker. For our third target word, I want you to think of someone you've known or worked with who's always cheerful and eager. They do their work quickly, willingly, and promptly. They do it with alacrity, our third target word. Alacrity is a noun that means a quick and cheerful readiness and eagerness to do something. Now, people who do their work with alacrity always seem to have a sparkle in their eye, a pep in their step, and a smile on their face. They're balls of energy. They're the eager beavers in your school or organization. If you want to be more formal in describing people who do things with alacrity, you could say that they do their work with a vivacious spirit, with animation and sprightliness, with an ebullience, or in an expeditious manner. More informal synonyms for alacrity that you might use in conversations with your friends so you don't sound too pretentious are get up and go, and vim and vigor. Additional synonyms include liveliness, zeal, avidity, and expedition. So let's put alacrity in context. The alacrity with which she dove into writing the research paper showed just how important it is to give students some choice in choosing their topics. Now, to remember alacrity, make a personal connection. In your vocabulary notebook, write down the name of someone you know, someone who always does his or her work with a cheerful eagerness. Now let's shift gears. For our next target word, I want you to think of the laziest people you know. These are the laggards, the slackers, loafers, and the clock watchers. They're the do-nothings who shirk their duty the first moment that the boss isn't looking. The malingerers who feign illness to get out of something. Remember malinger, our target word from a previous lecture. The procrastinators who dilly-dally and dawdle, frittering away the hours and piddling away the time. Our target word for these lazy folks is indolent. Indolent is an adjective meaning habitually lazy and slow. tending to avoid exertion. The great 20th century British moral philosopher Bernard Williams observed, "I like the word indolence. It makes my laziness seem classy." Some wonderful synonyms for indolent include sluggish, idle, the L words, lackadaisical, languid, lethargic, and listless, and one that I particularly like, slothful. Slothful is a terrific word that just sounds like what it means. Let's put indolent in context. The indolent writer never made it out of bed before noon. He was usually too lazy to check the credibility of his sources and rarely made his deadlines. So to remember this word, say it slowly and lazily. Indolent. It sort of sounds slow and sluggish, doesn't it? It rolls off the tongue in an indolent, lazy fashion. Make a personal connection. Think of a time that you were particularly indolent. Perhaps a Saturday afternoon when you were tired and didn't feel like doing a darn thing and decided to drift off on the couch and nap the afternoon away. Write that experience next to the word indolent in your vocabulary notebook. All right, let's review our first four target words. Sedulous, facile, alacrity, and indolent with the situation game. Okay, situation one. You're the founder of an internet startup company, and you've just hired two new computer programmers. One has average computer programming ability, but is an incredibly hard worker, never stopping until he's written a code that works perfectly. The other programmer is a little bit lazy, but when she does decide to work, she solves any programming problem almost effortlessly. Which programmer is sedulous, and which one has the facile mind? Answer, the first hard-working programmer is sedulous, diligent and dogged in his work. The second programmer has the facile mind, solving programming problems with incredible ease. Now, what other target word could you use to describe the laziness of the facile programmer? Answer, indolent. Situation two. 2 weeks later, you've hired a third employee. This individual does his work quickly, efficiently, but is always a bit cynical, grumbling about the work or dropping snide comments under his breath. Does this employee do his work with alacrity? Why or why not? Answer, alacrity means cheerful eagerness, working quickly, willingly, and promptly. While this third employee is quick and prompt, one component of the meaning of alacrity, he sure as heck isn't cheerful or eager. Now, let's move on to our next set of words. And the first one I want to talk about is torpor. Now, when I think of torpor, I immediately think of the state that my son is in when we try to wake him up for school in the morning. Now, Jack is an awesome son with so many wonderful qualities, but he's got two things that make it hard to awake him in the mornings. One, he's a night owl. And two, and more importantly, he's a teenager. And if you've ever tried to wake a teenager up for school in the mornings, you know in your very bones of what I speak. He'll shuffle down the stairs, bleary-eyed and sluggish and lethargic. Watching him move in the morning is like watching a movie in slow motion. It seems like he doesn't really start moving until we actually hear the bus engine coming from the next street over. And then, bam, it's like a switch is flipped. He breaks out of his state of torpor, and he's off, flying down the hill to hopefully make the bus. Torpor is a noun. It means a state of sluggishness, a state of mental or physical inactivity, lethargy, apathy. Torpid, the adjective form of torpor, means slow, sluggish, lethargic, dull, benumbed. After running a marathon, you might feel torpid. Torpid can also be used to describe someone who shows little interest in something, who's apathetic. Let's put torpor and torpid in context. The teenage boys were aroused from their torpor by the promise of all the free pizza they could eat. And we've finally broken out of the torpid economic growth following the recession. The economy's booming. You might also hear torpor used to describe the mind and ideas. Not having read or discussed anything stimulating for over 40 years, his mind had grown torpid from lack of use. So, do you think the word torpor is related to the word torpedo? The answer is yes, but not in a straightforward way. Torpor comes from the Latin word torpeo, meaning to be numb, inactive, or dull. And appropriately, the ancient Romans called the long, round fish that numbed anyone who touched it with an electric shock a torpedo. The English followed suit, and in the 16th century used the term torpedo to refer to the fish that we know today as electric rays. And this brings us to the early 1800s, when Robert Fulton created a floating device that exploded when it came into contact with a ship. He needed a name for this device, which we would call a mine today, and thought it reminded him of the electric ray, the torpedo. Of course, today's torpedoes look different than Fulton's mines and don't float, but move through the water at a rapid rate. However, the result is the same. They make the enemy numb and inactive. So, to remember torpor, connect it to torpedo, a weapon which will numb the enemy, or worse. Also, make a connection to your own life. Think of a time you were in a torpor. Perhaps you were dog-tired after a difficult workout, or after a long night up with a sick child, or the morning after an all-night party. Jot this personal connection down in your vocabulary notebook. And the next time you're in a torpor, try a quadruple shot of espresso to jolt you back to life and get you moving again. Okay, we have a usage alert here. Torpid and torpor are commonly confused with turgid and turbid. So, I think it's a good idea to make those our next two target vocabulary words. That'll help us keep the meanings straight. Let's start with turbid. Turbid is an adjective that means muddy, thick or opaque with sediment, cloudy, obscured. Turbid's often used to describe roiled, muddy water with lots of sediment so stirred up that you can't see the bottom. Or liquid that's heavy, thick, and dense, as in, the turbid river, full of mud and debris from the flood, made it nearly impossible for the rescue teams to recover the missing. Turbid can also mean confused, muddled, disordered. In this sense, turbid can be used in a more figurative sense to describe muddled ideas and unclear writing and thinking, as in, the writer received his 100th rejection letter from the publisher, which stated, "Your turbid prose has confused our readers. They had no idea who the main characters were, or even if you had gone to the trouble of including a plot." Turbid includes the root T-U-R-B, which comes from the Latin word turba, meaning turmoil or confusion. The root can also carry the connotation of spinning and whirling. When you spin and whirl, things are thrown into disorder. So what other words that share the T-U-R-B root do you already know that can help you remember turbid? How about turbulent, disturb, perturb, imperturbable, and turbine? Turbulent will be our key word for the T-U-R-B root. Something that's turbulent is disorderly, tumultuous, unruly. So whenever you see turbid, I want you to think of a turbulent river, one that's disturbed and muddy. Turbid, turbulent. Use our related word strategy here. In your vocabulary notebook, highlight the T-U-R-B root in turbid and write, "A turbulent river will probably be turbid with muddy water." Now, how is disturbed related to the root T-U-R-B? Well, when you're disturbed, you're completely confused and agitated. And what does a water turbine do? It spins and whirls, creating confusion in the water by stirring it up. And if you are imperturbable, you are not able to be disturbed. So, torpid means slow and sluggish. Think teenager in the morning. And turbid means muddy, confused, and muddled. Think turbulence. How about our third commonly confused word of this trio? Turgid. Turgid is an adjective that means swollen and distended, puffy, as in the disease had ravaged his body, leading to swollen limbs and turgid facial features. Now, in a more figurative sense, turgid also refers to language that's swollen, pompous, and bombastic. Turgid language is over the top, puffed up, swollen with ostentatious sounding words and lofty phrases. Turgid collocates with language and prose. In common phrases you might encounter like turgid language and turgid prose. Let's put turgid in context. The love song's turgid lyrics and hackneyed expressions made us all want to gag. Now, since the related word strategy doesn't work with turgid, let's use the word part connection strategy. I remember turgid by highlighting the URG, the urge in turgid, and say, I urge you not to write in turgid swollen prose. Write in short, clear sentences instead. Or, when you splurge on food, your stomach will become turgid or swollen. You might remember turgid by linking it to a political speech you've heard that was full of lofty-sounding phrases or swollen language. Or contrast it with the opposite. For example, you might remember that Ernest Hemingway did not write in turgid prose. Just the opposite. He wrote in clear, spare, pithy prose. Write Ernest Hemingway with a big X over his name next to turgid, if this helps. Let's finish with the definition clue activity to review our final four words, torpor, torpid, turgid, and turbid. Okay, number one, this word means slow, sluggish, lethargic, and is related to a word referring to a fish that numbs its prey. Answer, torpid. Okay, number two, this word can describe muddy, roiled rivers that you can't see through. In a figurative sense, it can also describe writing that's confused, muddled, and difficult to understand. Answer, turbid. Number three, this word can refer to swollen limbs or swollen, highfalutin talk, like the kind you hear from a mayoral candidate that's just a bunch of hot air. Answer, turgid. Okay, let's finish today's lecture with a high-utility Greek-Latin root pair that means work. We'll start with O-P-E-R, the Latin root meaning work. Our key word for O-P-E-R will be operate, which means to work or function. In your vocabulary notebook, write that when an engine operates properly, it's working and functioning as it should. Now, what other words can you think of that include the O-P-E-R root? How about cooperate, to work together, and cooperative, uncooperative, and inoperable, and opus, a work or composition, and magnum opus, someone's masterpiece, literally a great work, and even the word opera, which English borrowed from the Italian opera, literally meaning a work, labor, composition. That's one hard-working root. Sorry, I couldn't help that one. Now, Greek also has a root meaning work, spelled E-R-G. Now, make sure you record the E-R-G next to O-P-E-R, so you know that this Greek-Latin root pair shares the same core meaning of work. Our key word for ERG will be energy. What's energy? It's the capacity or power to do work. So write energy down in your notebook and highlight the ERG. Other derived words from ERG include erg, a unit of work or energy, ergonomics, the study of the relationship between workers and their environment, Synergy, S-Y-N, is the Greek word part meaning together. So, synergy is the combined effect of working together. And metallurgy, the science or technique of working with or extracting metals. And let's end today's lecture on work with a word you can use at your work, ergophobia. Now, you may not have heard of ergophobia before, but I bet if you break it down, you can figure out its meaning. Yes, you guessed it. Ergophobia is an abnormal fear of work. So the next time your boss accuses you of not being sedulous, but of being an indolent sloth who's always in a state of torpor at work, tell him that you've got a diagnosed medical condition called ergophobia, and you may just have to take the rest of the week off work. Doctor's orders.
Lecture 20, Words That Break and Words That Join.
You've probably heard that Billboard number one hit song by Neil Sedaka from 1962 called Breaking Up Is Hard to Do. And of course, that's not the only pop song that deals with the heartache of saying goodbye. In fact, that's pretty much been a staple of rock and roll from the beginning. Breaking up, getting back together, breaking up again. Where would songwriters be without this crazy human tension between joining together and pulling apart? Lucky for songwriters, and for the rest of us as well, English has a number of rich vocabulary words that center on these opposing concepts of breaking things apart and putting things together. So in this lecture, we'll explore 8 such target words. And along the way, we'll be answering the following questions. What in the world is a lacuna? And does it have anything to do with a lagoon? Number 2, does the word cleave, one of our target words, mean to split apart? Or the exact opposite, to stick closely to? And 3, would you rather join a cabal or a coterie? And which group is most likely to have, as a member, a power-hungry madman with a sinister air about him? Okay, so for our first target word, imagine this. You're a new member of the local chess club, attending the annual summer barbecue to commemorate a great year. All of the chess club members seem to be enjoying themselves, eating barbecue chicken and sipping cold lemonade in the shade to ward off the sweltering August heat. Then, all of a sudden, the 2 top chess players, your chess idols, get into it, arguing over the advantages of the Sicilian defense versus the queen's gambit. I know, big mistake. The discussion becomes heated. Other chess club members start joining in and taking sides. The argument gets out of hand. The attacks become personal, one member even calling another a mere pawn being used by others. A rumble ensues as chessboards are scattered, bishops, rooks, and knights start flying. The barbecue breaks up, with both sides refusing to speak to one another ever again. This rift in your chess club is called a schism, our first target word. Schism, a noun, is a division among the members of a group into opposing factions because of a disagreement. Schism can be pronounced 2 ways, schism and schism. Now, while there can definitely be a schism in a chess club, schisms are often used to describe divisions of a more serious nature, such as a rift within a profession, a region, a political party, and most commonly, a religion. Let's put schism in context. A theological argument split the religious community in 2, leading to a long-lasting schism that still exists today. Now, synonyms and related words for schism include split, rift, division, parting of the ways, falling out, fracture, and a few that I particularly like, rupture, fissure, breach, and cleft. You can refer to the groups that have split off from a main group as splinter groups and factions. Now, schism comes from the Greek schisma, meaning division or cleft, and is related to two other words that you already know that can help you remember its meaning. Scissors, which cut or split things in two, and schizophrenia, literally the splitting of the mind. What a helpful visual and connections to words that you already know. So to remember schism, highlight the S, C, H, and schism in your vocabulary notebook and write the related words scissors and schizophrenia. Remember, scissors cut or split things in two, just like a schism. Now, you'll also hear the term the Great Schism applied to the 11th century division of the Christian church into what would later become the Roman Catholic Church, based in Rome, and the Eastern Orthodox Church, based in Byzantium, now known as Istanbul. Now, what do you think our next target word, diaspora, means? Do you think it means the flight of a group of people from a catastrophe? Or the dispersion of a people from their original homeland? If you said the second answer, you're correct. Diaspora is a noun that refers to the movement, migration, or scattering of a people away from an established or ancestral homeland. Let's put diaspora in context. Like many families who left their homeland during the diaspora, they struggled to retain their culture in their new country. Now, diaspora can also refer to the actual group of people who have settled far from their ancestral homelands, or the place where these people live. Now, diaspora comes from two Greek words, dia and spherein, which were joined together as a compound word meaning to scatter across. The word was used in the Bible to refer to the scattering of the Jewish communities outside Palestine, or modern-day Israel, and after their exile by the Babylonians. Capitalized diaspora when used to refer to this Jewish diaspora. However, diaspora has added a more general meaning to describe any large movement or migration of people or culture. We're moving on from two words that have to do with splitting and scattering, schism and diaspora, to our third word that has to do with what's left when something is taken away, lacuna. For lacuna, think about this. Have you ever wondered why English has gender-specific words for siblings, brother for a male sibling, and sister for a female sibling, and gender-specific words for parents, mom for a female parent, and dad for a male parent, but no similar gender-specific word for male cousins and female cousins? I mean, there's no muzzins for male cousins, or fuzzins for female cousins. It's all just cousins, right? Or have you wondered why we do have general collective terms for mom and dad, parents, and sister and brother, siblings, but no collective term for aunts and uncles? In linguistics, holes like this are called lexical gaps. You might expect a word for something based on patterns found elsewhere in your language, but instead, you get a gap. This gap, this missing word, this hole or break in the pattern is an example in language of a lacuna, our next target word. A lacuna, a noun, is a missing gap or hole where something should be. When something's taken away, you're left with a gap, a hole, or a cavity. The plural for lacuna is lacunae. You'll hear lacuna often used to refer to missing sections of books that have been censored or removed, and parts of ancient texts that have gone missing. Let's put lacuna in context. Although the ancient manuscript was recovered, the notably large lacuna at the beginning made it very confusing. And in medicine, a lacuna can refer to a small cavity in an anatomical structure, like a cavity in a bone. Now, lacuna comes from the Latin lacuna, meaning hole or pit. Now, what other word do you know that looks like lacuna? It's somewhat similar in spelling. How about lagoon? Lacuna is related to lake and lagoon, which are holes, pits, or cavities that are filled with water. There's our related word strategy at work again. Lacuna and lagoon look alike and share the same core meaning. And that answers the first question from the beginning of our lecture. So, to remember lacuna, highlight the L-A-C in the word and connect it to a lagoon. But a lagoon that is empty, that's a pit or cavity. In your vocabulary notebook next to the word lacuna, draw a picture of a lake without water, with the words gap, hole, and missing next to it. And think of a gap or missing part in your life, something that's missing, but that should be there. Perhaps you took an astronomy class in college, but have since forgotten a lot. If so, there's a large lacuna in your understanding of astronomy. Or perhaps a close friend moved away, leaving a lacuna in your personal life. Make this personal connection and connect it to lacuna in your vocabulary notebook. Okay, for our next target word, we move from lacuna, a gap or a hole, to another type of opening. Now imagine this. You've just come home late after a long, hard day at work. In your rush that day, you missed breakfast, forgot to bring lunch, and haven't had dinner yet. You're ravenous. With hunger clawing at you from the inside, you rush into the kitchen, fling open the fridge, and begin tearing into the fried chicken, ripping flesh from bone while simultaneously scooping handfuls of mashed potatoes into your pie hole and gulping a beer to wash it all down your gullet. Your significant other, appalled at your barbaric eating, reprimands you, scolding, "Stop stuffing all that food down your maw, you beast!" Now you know how much I love short, powerful words. That's why I love our next word, maw, one of my all-time favorites. Maw is a noun referring to the mouth, throat, or gullet of an animal, particularly a carnivorous animal. Now, you'll hear the word used to refer to the mouth and jaws of voracious, carnivorous, ferocious beasts, as in staring directly into the gaping maw of the ravenous lion, he lost all courage and ran like hell the other way. Or, maw can be used to refer to a cavernous opening that resembles the jaws of an animal. As in, at the end of the horror movie, you see her soul being sucked down into the gaping maw of hell. Or, maw can be used in a more figurative sense to refer to the metaphorical center of a voracious appetite. As in, the paparazzi will go to any lengths to get scurrilous pictures of celebrities, knowing the need to feed the insatiable maw of the scandal-loving public. You'll encounter the common phrase gaping maw of, as in the gaping maw of hell, or the gaping maw of darkness. You might also read the phrase feed the maw of, with the writer inserting whatever is hungry, be it big business, government, or the public, to describe a metaphorical hunger for something. Now maw, as is common with many single-syllable words, comes from the Old English word maga, meaning stomach. So to remember maw, draw a picture of a mouth in your vocabulary notebook with all the other wonderful synonyms and related words for mouth, including craw, gullet — I had to pour a pot of coffee down his gullet just to jolt him out of his stupor — jaws, muzzle, pie hole, as in shut your pie hole, not a phrase for the faint-hearted, gob, yap, trap, chops, and the always descriptive kisser, that hackneyed phrase from 1940s era pulp crime movies. I punched him right in the kisser. Let's review the first four words: schism, diaspora, lacuna, and maw, using the definition clue review game. I'll provide the definition and a clue, and you identify the target word. Okay, number one, this word is a missing hole or gap where something should be. Often refers to missing parts of books or manuscripts. Answer, lacuna. Number two, this word refers to the movement, migration, or scattering of a people away from an established or ancestral homeland. Answer, diaspora. Number three, this word refers to a division in a group into two opposing factions. Answer, schism. Number four, this word refers to the mouth, throat, or gullet of an animal, or, in a figurative sense, the metaphorical center of a voracious appetite. Answer, maw. Okay, before we start into our second set of target words, let's briefly explore two important Latin roots that fit perfectly with today's lecture. Our first root is rupt, R-U-P-T, meaning break. You'll see this root in derived words like rupture. This will be our key word for rupt. Something that is ruptured is broken or burst. Bankrupt, when your finances are broken. Disrupt, the prefix dis means apart, so to disrupt is to break apart. Interrupt, the prefix inter means between, so an interruption is a break between things. Erupt, to break out. And a word you may not be as familiar with, eruption. Now the initial IR in eruption is an absorbed prefix, a variant spelling of the prefix IN, meaning into. Remember those absorbed prefixes from a previous lecture? So, an eruption is a sudden, violent breaking or bursting in. Eruption can be used to describe a sudden population increase in the plant or animal population of a region. Now, in direct contrast to rupt, meaning break, is the Latin root junct, J-U-N-C-T, meaning join. You'll see junct in derived words like juncture, our key word for junct, the time, place, or point at which two things are joined, and conjunction. Con is a variant spelling of the Latin prefix com, meaning with. So a conjunction is a word that connects or joins with other words. Write these two important roots, rupt and junct, in your vocabulary notebook, and be on the lookout for derived words that contain these roots. Okay, now we're moving from our root break onto the second half of our lecture. The first target word in this section is cleave. Now, do you think cleave means A, to split or divide by cutting? Or the opposite, B, to stick closely to cling to? If you said A, to split or divide, you're right. And if you said B, to stick closely to, you're also right. I asked you a trick question at the beginning of the lecture. So, cleave means both to split apart and to stick closely to. Two meanings that are the opposite of each other. In other words, cleave is its own antonym. Kind of strange, huh? Words which are their own antonyms are called contronyms, or Janus words, named after the Roman god Janus, the two-faced god of gates, doorways, and beginnings and endings, who faces both ways looking towards the future and back into the past. And the Romans named January, the month that's at the beginning of one year and the beginning of the next, in his honor. Other Janus words in English include buckle, which can mean either to fasten together, as in I buckled my belt, or to bend and break, as in my knees buckled. And bolt can mean either to secure and lock, as in bolt the door, or to run, to make a sudden dash, sudden swift run, as in the rabbit bolted toward the undergrowth when it saw the dog. Okay, let's return to cleave. Let's start with the first definition for the verb cleave, to split or divide by cutting, as in, if you want to cleave the steak in two, use the sharp meat cleaver over there. That's an easy way to remember the cutting meaning of cleave. A meat cleaver cleaves meat. Or you might hear cleave used in the sense of to make or create by cutting or dividing, as in, the swift sailboat cleaved a path through the choppy water. Now on to the second definition of cleave, meaning to cling to adhere closely to stick to. You can literally cleave to someone, as in, the baby boy cleaves to his mother. Or you can cleave or cling to something in a more figurative sense, as in, despite the temptations of college life, he cleaved to the principles his parents had instilled in him in his youth. Now, the reason cleave has two opposite meanings is that it really is two distinct words that happen to be spelled the same. And these two word meanings evolved from two different words of Germanic origin. To remember that cleave has two meanings, next to cleave in your vocabulary notebook, you could draw a picture of a meat cleaver that cuts or cleaves, the first meaning, next to a bottle of glue that sticks or adheres, the second meaning. In fact, the English word glue comes from the same Indo-European base that cleave, meaning to stick to, comes from. Now, cleave was the perfect word to serve as our transition between the breaking words like schism and diaspora that we explored in the first section of today's lecture, and the joining words we'll be discussing in the second section, because cleave could fit into either of these categories. We're now moving to another word in this joining category, concatenation. Now, for concatenation, I want to tell you a story about my father-in-law, Glenn, and a moment that changed the rest of his life. It was 1945, and he was 14 years old, working on a farm in South Dakota. His mom had remarried and moved to Connecticut, and his older brothers and sister were all grown and making their own way in the world. Even at the age of 14, Glenn was already doing the work of a hired farmhand. But the farmer's sister who lived with them insisted that, on top of his full-time work, he take on the job of feeding the chickens and cleaning their coop. That was the last straw. Glenn packed up his belongings in a rucksack, walked the 5 miles to his grandmother's house in town, and eventually joined his mother in Connecticut by traveling on a troop transport train that was jam-packed with soldiers returning home at the end of World War II. And thus, Glenn never became a farmer. Instead, he finished high school in Connecticut, attended and graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, and later, while serving in the Navy and on leave in San Francisco, met his wife Pat on a blind date. What a chain of events leading from that one decision back in 1945. Glenn still says, if that farmer's sister hadn't done that, I'd still be working on a farm in South Dakota to this day. And we tell our own kids to be thankful for that farmer's sister, because without her or those chickens, they wouldn't be here today either. So we can use our next target word, concatenation, a noun, to refer to a series of things that are linked together like a chain, like ideas or events, or like Glenn's story. Let's put concatenation in context. All of our lives, like Glenn's, can be seen as a concatenation of events that has led us to where we are today. Or, the improbable concatenation of mistakes at the power plant led to a nuclear meltdown. It was the perfect storm. Now, you can remember this word by breaking it down into its two parts. First, there's the prefix con, a variant of com, meaning with or together. And second, there's the Latin base catena, which means a chain. So to remember concatenation, draw a picture of a chain to represent different things that are connected together, like events or ideas. Make a personal connection. Have you ever thought of a concatenation of events, similar to Glenn's story, that led to your life today? Perhaps if your grandmother hadn't moved west, or your father hadn't taken that job, you wouldn't be here today. Jot down this concatenation, this series of connected events, in your vocabulary notebook. Now, when you join things, as we've been doing in the second section of the lecture, you bring them together. People can also join groups. Our final two target words describe two different types of groups that you might join. For this word, imagine a secret underground room somewhere in the world. And 10 shady-looking characters are all huddled around a conference table, whispering with wicked grins, gleefully rubbing their hands together, secretly plotting to take over the world. At this point, you're probably wondering whether you're witnessing the opening scene of a really bad B-movie. You might be, but you're also seeing the inner workings and machinations of a cabal, our next target word. Cabal is a noun that can refer to a small group of people secretly working together, as in, the fourth grade cabal of Jimmy, Zach, and Trent had secretly plotted to start a food fight at lunch, but were ratted out by a classmate and punished by Principal Zimmerman. Or, cabal can refer to the actual secret plot itself, as in this time of terrible political and civil unrest, the opposition party's cabal to overthrow the government by force just might work. Cabal originally comes from Kabbalah, a Jewish mystical method of interpreting scripture that became associated with the secret and the occult. Cabal was later popularized and given its present meaning by a 17th century cabal of five English ministers who served under King Charles II. The members of this powerful royal council were named Clifford, Arlington, Buckingham, Ashley, and Lauderdale. And by strange coincidence, if you took the initial letters of their names, you got the spelling of cabal. So, to remember cabal, you might read up on the history of these five privy counselors to the English king. Or you might think of a time that you secretly got together with a group of friends to plot some dastardly deed, perhaps as a teenager with your friends plotting to sneak out at night after your parents went to bed. Make a personal connection to the word and try not to get caught. For our last target word, I'd like to tell you about a club I just started about a year ago. It's a guy's book club. Or should I say a guy's beer and book club? In that order, some of our members like to joke. Now, all the book clubs that I knew about were women's book clubs. So I gathered a bunch of male friends who all loved reading, talking about books, and trying out different beers. We try and pair the beer and the book, but this isn't a requirement. Now, we read the gamut from lighter fare, like Get Shorty, by that master of dialogue and crime fiction, Elmore Leonard, to more serious reading. Right now, we're trying to plow through that best-selling tome that everyone's talking about, but no one seems to have finished, Capital in the 21st Century, an influential economic treatise that's getting a lot of play in the news these days. We're still trying to find a beer that's serious and mature enough to stand up to the book. Now, my book club's an example of a coterie. Coterie is a noun referring to a small, often select group of persons who associate with one another frequently and share a common interest, background, or purpose. Let's put coterie in context. It was really a tight-knit coterie of presidential advisors who made all the important decisions in that administration. As you can see, coterie is often followed by the collocate of, as in a coterie of skiers or a coterie of power brokers. Synonyms and related words for coterie include sisterhood or brotherhood, society or troop. A sect. Sect is often used to identify a religious group who may be exclusive and possibly deviates from the mainstream religious tradition. A faction. A group of people, often a dissentious group within a larger group. A clique. Use clique if you want to emphasize the exclusive, closed-off, snobby nature of a group. And a band, ring, circle, cadre, gang, and clan. All right, let's review our last four words. Cleave, concatenation, cabal, and coterie, using the situation review activity. Situation one, you're on the phone listening to a friend tell you about his day. He's listing a bunch of random events that don't seem to be related to anything at all. Could you use concatenation to refer to this group of events? Why or why not? Probably not. Concatenation refers to a chain of events, things or ideas that are linked all together like a chain, interconnected or related in some way. Your friend's events are scattered and random, so concatenation won't work. Situation two. A group of explorers is using machetes to cut a path through a dense jungle. What target word could you use to describe this action that's creating a path, and how might you use it? Answer, cleave. The explorers are cleaving a path through the dense jungle. Situation 3. After a long wait, you've finally been invited to join a fairly exclusive local hiking group that meets weekly to talk about all their new cool gear and even once in a while actually go for a hike. Is this hiking group an example of a cabal or a coterie? This group is a coterie, a small, often select group of persons who associate with one another frequently and share a common interest, like talking about hiking gear that they probably won't use. However, if your hiking group was meeting in secret and plotting to steal its gear and sell it on the black market, then it would